Tonight we have a panel of three individuals. Dr. Cliff Cutler, who's been practicing medicine for over 35 years, 38 years, as a general practitioner here in the Salt Lake Valley. He has come across a number of people who have had near-death experiences, and it has been quite influential on him, one of the reasons why he comes to these meetings, and he'll be willing to share some of those stories with us. We also have Lily Johnson, who runs an art center right here in the Salt Lake Valley, had two childhood NDEs that she was told to never talk about, and she's breaking that advice tonight. Michael Herring, who was a construction worker on the Tabernacle, and who had an aneurysm while he was working on it, and died and had some interesting experiences there. And so this is our panel tonight. These are people we've never heard from before. Let me hand the microphone off to our first speaker, Michael Herring.
Good evening, everybody. I'm going to preface the story with the two things I need to preface the story with is when it started when I was about 16 years old, I had a sudden onset of migraines just out of the blue, severe ones that were debilitating. They would come and go. Most of the time I got okay with it, using certain medication, other things like that. And the other thing was also from about that time, very severely suicidal. By the time that my NDE occurred, I had approximately 50 suicide attempts. So, take that into account. No, I usually had something. I would preface it with something from the other side always stopping me, right? So, without further ado, what occurred was on July 17th, 1999, which is very long this day in this state, ironically it was that day, I was working on the LDS Conference Center. I was an electrician there, running temporary power crew over a very, very large job site. If you've ever been up there, you know how big that building is. About 9 o'clock in the morning, I started into a migraine. It was very, very quick onset. It took about 5 minutes, and I was in full-blown migraine mode. Normally, it took about 35, 40 minutes to do it. I got a hold of my foreman. It was above me. He gave me a couple of Mylo, which ironically, I don't know whether it was what killed me or what actually worked, but it seemed to work. Gave me a set of earplugs, told me to go find a cold, dark place and go to sleep it off, because he got migraines on a regular basis himself, and he just clocked me out, and when I got back, I clocked back in. So I did. One of the things that you probably don't know, even if you have knowledge, you're in that building, is there's catacombs under that building. They're actually the return air duct. The air drops from the ceiling, comes out the floor, or vice versa, depending on the season. Went as far down in those as I could get. It's the quietest place on the job site. I had over 2,000 people working on it. It's a pretty noisy place all the time. Put in the earplugs, cut my heart out, went to sleep. I don't know how much time passed. There's always something in the background when it felt like 3 hours passed, but I don't know for sure. And I woke up. Headache was gone. My lower back pain, which I've been having problems since I was about 17, 18, because I've been working in this trade since I was 13 as an electrician, there wasn't any pain at all, which was kind of a little weird, but I'm thinking, good drugs. So I decided, all right, I'm going to go back to work. So I crawl out, and I look behind, and as I'm crawling out about halfway out the tunnel back to the main passageway, I look back and see myself lying on the ground. Once again, don't think anything of this. Yeah, in the slightest, which is a little odd to look back on it. I'm like, okay, I gotta get back to work. I've got stuff I gotta do. I gotta make sure certain things are done. I had a long list of things that had to be done that day. I'm like, okay, whatever. Stood up, started walking down the hallway. The hallway is curved round because it is an auditorium. I got towards the edge right where the staircase was. There had been a problem during a lot of work, concrete pours in the area where the concrete forms hadn't matched up exactly. There was sometimes upwards of a 6-inch jolt in the concrete. And because it was an air passage, they had to go in there and grind it at least somewhat smooth. And I will never forget to this day, and I have run across him once, ironically 2 days ago, the same Mexican who was standing up on top of a 5-gallon bucket with a grinder grinding out this concrete. Don't know what possessed me to do this, but I wanted to stick my hand through the grinder. And the next thing I did, I knew I was at his height, sticking my hand through the grinder. I was like, huh, that was interesting. Nothing happened. I'm like, okay. Next thing I know, back down on the ground. It was at this point I noticed I hadn't been walking. this entire time. I've been floating about 2 inches above the ground. Again, thinking, all right, the drugs are being real weird in my head right now. So I go towards the staircase that goes actually all the way to the roof. Right before I get to the stairs, it felt like I hit a giant bubble. I pushed on it, pushed it back. This went on for probably 2 or 3 minutes, and I just finally got frustrated and just rammed the bubble and broke through. I taken 7 steps. I started floating very, very rapidly. Now, the thing to be noted about this is up until the time I crossed that bubble, everything was in color, just like you and I see everything normally. It very quickly changed. It started going into a black and white mode at that point. As I was floating up to the floors, I could see everybody working. I knew who in various different rooms. I was going up and above the building. I saw the people on top of it. And the higher I got, the more it was like a mist was coming up underneath me. I do remember one very distinct thing that stuck with me and I thought was very odd considering what happened later that day. I saw a funnel cloud start at the Delta Center and go the exact path the tornado would later take that day. Shortly after I saw that, as I'm floating up towards just whiteness, there's nothing else behind me. And I am totally, completely white. Up, down, there was no difference. You know, I was standing on something, I just don't know what it was. And I wandered around for probably what felt like 10 or 15 minutes in this just white mist and not knowing where I was at, very confused. And then my great-grandmother, who died when I was about 6 or 7 months old, showed up, very clear, plain as day. I had never seen a picture of my great-grandmother when she was young until about 2 years after this occurred. But that was her at about age 20. She was dressed in a gray spotted sundress, her hair pulled back in a style approximately about 1940. She walked up to me and said, "Why are you here? Where am I?" And she's like, "Okay, what did you do? Why are you here? You're not supposed to be here." I'm like, "Once again, where am I?" This goes on for about what seemed like 20 minutes of this arguing back and forth. And then she's finally like, "All right, come on." Takes my hand and start walking. As we walk, the white disappears. And we're standing in the middle of a bowl. You think about the very common parks this area builds that are actually for drainage overflow in case of storms. It's kind of like that. It was just sunk down a little bit. Very large. It was probably 6 or 7 football fields long and about 2 or 3 football fields wide. Anyway, so it's running 1,000 yards to about 600 yards across. And there were all sorts of people there. There were people that were completely in white. There were people who were dressed like you and me from various different times in history. And the very distinct thing I remember about this is I had just come back from Ireland came back in May. This was July, so a few months earlier. I remember very distinctly Ireland was the most beautiful, greenest place in the world I'd ever seen. Everything there in this bowl was alive, alive. It just glowed life. It made Ireland look like burned out husk of life. There was a giant oak tree. And when I mean giant, I mean giant oak tree off on one side. It was so big at the base you could probably put 30, 40 people linking hands together and still not make it around it. Just absolutely massive tree. Don't know why it was there still to this day. And the sky. It was the most... I have an image in my head and I can't describe it. It was purplish, pinkish, orange, like you'd expect to see in the most brilliant sunrise or sunset of your life. And just, as I said, there's not words to describe how brilliant it was. And I'm like, okay. So you take me to see my people. Where are we at then? Very obstinate, arrogant person again, notice. And she's like, "Well, you're here, you're home." I'm like, "Really?" I started asking a series of questions. Unfortunately, I can't tell you what they asked because it's not because they're blocked. I don't have words to describe how they were asked. Because as soon as I would ask them, they were instantaneously answered. There's feelings I come back with about it, as to what those were. Don't know whether they were right or wrong. But I've tried to live my life according to them since I came back. to preface that note. And it seemed like I was there for 3 or 4 weeks just asking questions. I don't know how time evolves there or here or how long anything's going on with any of this occurred. And then all of a sudden she said, we have to go right now. A very hurried voice, and took my hand and led me out of there very quickly. And I saw what looked like a dark doorway, and she's like, you need to go. I'm like, I don't want to go. So you have to go. This goes on for about 10 minutes. Can't tell, I'm a little stubborn. And finally, she's like, all right, I give up. And the next thing I know, I feel like I'm about 6 years old. I look up. I see a smiling, bright, beaming face. Looks down at me. Holds out his arm. Says, Michael, you need to go home. So give me a hug. You need to go home now. I only asked why I said this, but this is what I said to him. I said, I don't want to go home, Grandpa. And he's like, you need to go home. Now, you'll come back to visit. You'll be there for a very, very long time. You have many, many, many things you have to do there. But don't worry, we'll still be here. And it was at that point that I noticed his hands. And I noticed the holes in his hands. I'm like, but I don't want to go, Grandpa. Don't make me go. He's like, you have to go, and you have to go now. And then it felt like a giant hand picked me, just slammed me back into my body. I was aching for 3 days. I woke up in a start and literally started screaming at God to take me back. It's like, why can't I stay? What the hell? And I was kind of in a daze. And I actually got up for real this time. Put my heart head back on, turned my radio back on, and went back to work. Great irony of this is, because of the main welder bank in the conference center had, somebody had cut the main leads to it, I had to slice them, so I had to work through lunch. Otherwise, I would have been at the conference center when the tornado hit. I remember walking out of it afterwards, looked up at the sky, I'd seen enough tornadoes when spending my summers in the Midwest and the time I grew up in East Texas. Looked at the sky, very sick pea green. I'm like, it's a really good thing to live in Utah, because otherwise I think that was a tornado. Walked to Cottonwood Mall, and while I was there, that's when the tornado occurred. To which, when I heard it over the radio, I'm like, no, there's not a tornado, we go. There's no way home. Walked out of the mall, and I'm like, okay, maybe there wasn't. And that's pretty much what happened with me.
I'm just an ordinary doctor. When I was 14 years of age, I made up my mind I was going to be a physician and followed that goal. When I was in medical school, some of my classmates said, you ought to go down and see that man in Virginia. He died and he's came back to life. And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. I'd like to do that, but medical school, you're a busy and don't do it. That man was George Ritchie, who really started this institution and the bringing to the public's attention that there is life after death. And we have in our midst experiencers, as this gentleman here, who can testify that they have been there and seen it and come back. I really didn't get excited about the near-death experience or that, or out-of-body experience. I remember one patient who was an elderly man, and this was the days when we first did cardioversion or shock therapy and cardiac massage for cardiac arrest. Terminal cancer. But in those days, we tried to save everybody, which was, in a way, foolish. Became more selective later on. But he came out of it, and he looked around the room and he said, where are those guys in white? He said, I wanted them to take me, and they wouldn't. And his wife says, she gets me out in the hall, and she says, what is he talking about, men in white? There's nobody in that room that was wearing white. do you think he saw something from the other side? I said, well, I don't know, but it kind of sounds like it. That was my first experience with the out-of-body experience. In 1982, I had a very unusual experience with a patient of mine. This woman, when I first started to practice in Murray as a general practitioner, she had a pulmonary embolism. This is where blood clots go from usually the legs or the pelvis up to the lungs. And she was very sick, but she recovered fully. And I became their family doctor. She developed, during her lifetime, rheumatoid arthritis. But she cheerfully went through life not really being bothered by these minor problems. She had a heart attack when she was in her 50s and went through this very well. She and her husband lived in a small home in the south part of the valley. She was a very emotionally stable person. She was not hysterical. She had her feet on the ground. If you were a Mormon bishop and you were looking for somebody to be the Relief Society president in your ward, this is the woman you'd choose, or one of the women you'd choose. When she was about 65 years of age, she had her second heart attack, and she was in Convent Hospital. And about 10:30 in the morning, I get a call from the ICU nurse, and she says, your patient has arrested. We need you over here quickly. I went over to the hospital, and her husband was standing outside the door. And they had a very close marriage, and he was sobbing uncontrollably. And he was, in fact, it's the worst expression of grief that I have ever experienced in my life. And I said a little prayer as I went into the ICU. Lord, help her live. Don't let her die. He won't be able to live without her. She had no pulse or blood pressure, and another physician was administering to her. But gradually, we began to get some electrical activity in her heart, and we began to feel a pulse. Her blood pressure was about 50. Gradually came up, and she was waking up. And we were hitting her face like this, calling her name. Pretty soon she answered. And I thought, well, this is fine, but will this just be repeated this afternoon? She didn't turn a hair. I can't explain this, but she looked better after her cardiac event than she did before. I can't explain that. I mean, people who have had cardiopulmonary resuscitation, they don't feel very good afterwards. 3 days after this event, I came into her room and she said, Dr. Culver, I almost died, didn't I? And she said, in fact, I did die. And I says, yes, you came about as close as you can come and still come back. And she says, I know, I was in the spirit world. Well, the hair on the back of my neck and my arms have stood on edge. And I said, would you care to tell me about this experience? And she said, I found myself in a room, a large room, and there were groups of about 10 people in the room. There were maybe about 8 or 10 groups. Two people would come and lead one person off from this group. And in my group, there's a short of stature, bald-headed fellow. And I didn't know a single person in that room. And finally, I was the only one left standing in the room. Everybody else had been let escorted out. And she said, the people there said, you really don't have to be here. You have a choice. You can either stay here or you can go back to Earth, go back to where you came from. And she thought of her husband, and she said, I thought of Blake, his name. I knew he wouldn't be able to live without me, so I decided to return. She used the same exact words as her husband did when I came in, exact to every letter. And she said, all the time there was this voice, and it kept asking us questions. And then the hairs went up on the back of my arms, and I said, what were the questions? And she said, this voice is a familiar voice. I've heard it before. But the first question they asked us was, have you experienced love? Has love been a part of your life? Have you learned to love others? And to me, it seemed like she was taking a central idea and transposing it into English and giving me three interpretations of essentially the same idea. Love, have you loved? Good question. The next question was, have you done your part? Have you made an effort to help others? Have you been active in other people's lives? It was the same associated ideas, a little different than what we think of it would be a judgment. The next question was, do you harbor any ill will towards anybody? Now there's a toughie. Do you harbor any ill will towards anybody? Then she said, have you ever killed anybody or deliberately harmed anybody? Another tough question. This country's been in a lot of wars. Then she said, have you been true to your husband? Have you been a good wife and good companion? Such as this. My patient looked to me like she was 10 years younger, and I can't explain why her physical condition just seemed to disappear. I have absolutely no explanation for this. When you think of it, when we die or go into the next world and our obituary appears in the newspaper, how many days have you read the obituaries and never seen anybody that you knew in the obituaries? That's the usual case, isn't it? We don't see our friends there. We see names of people we don't know. And that's exactly how she described her experience. And then she said, there's a number of other questions, but I can't remember. She said, there's one question that's really peculiar. I says, what was that? And she said, do you harbor any ill will towards those who cared for you medically? That is what she said. And I thought to myself, I am going to drive a truck. I can't take this responsibility. How can I be responsible on a heavenly level for my actions here on this earth? The next day, I went to the ICU nurse who had been on duty when my patient was arrested. I said, what happened to Mrs. So-and-so? She says, well, the IV got away from us. But she didn't get any more than 4 milligrams. Well, she was receiving a drug called xylocaine, which is a local anesthetic. The dose is 1 milligram to 4 milligrams a minute. And she was quick to point out that she didn't think that she got overdosed. But she didn't know for sure. And that would explain her arrest, that when they get an overdose of this medication, this would cause a drop in blood pressure and a cardiac arrest. She lived for, I'd say, a year afterwards. And one day she made a phone call to her daughter in Denver, lay down on her bed, and died. Her husband was as solid as a rock at the viewing, that this experience had been necessary for him. Well, this got me interested in out-of-body experiences because I knew this patient was telling the truth. This was no illusion or delusion. This really happened for her. I saw in the newspaper an ad about a George Ritchie, a man from Virginia, was going to speak to a curious sort of group of people called IANS was their name, International Association for Near-Death Studies. My wife, who was a supreme skeptic, attended with me with another physician and his wife, and we heard Dr. George Richard speak, and I said, here is a whole aspect of life I know nothing about, and I'm supposed to be a physician and help people. And I came down here to this location and met people who were, quote, experiencers, who had out-of-the-body experiences. And I guess that I probably, in my own family and in my associates, run across 20 people who've had this experience of dying and living again. It is a true experience. It's very upsetting to some people. It's hard for them to accept the fact that they're living and we're dead. I think I'll stop right there.
My name is Lilith Johnson, and I'm outing tonight. This is the first time I've actually spoken to people about the experiences I've had. The important thing here is that it's not necessarily about me and my experience as to the good that came from what happened to me and how the string has never been cut. That's the easiest way I can say it, is that it's like there's still an umbilical cord attached to me, and I feel like I am blessed every moment of every day, and I see thousands of miracles, and a lot of them happen to me myself and for the people around me. I was 8 years old, or close to it, and I was playing at a playground, and I lived in Draper. It was Draper Elementary, and it's right next door to a cemetery. They had what we called monkey bars at the time, and I was out there playing and having a good time, going to the top, and I don't remember falling. I don't remember kids around me or things that were going on, but I do remember seeing physicians, like in a hospital, with a white mask on. The second incident, I have to tell you both, because after that it gets a little kind of crazy. The second incident is at the same school, and they used to have a toy that went around in a circle that you would push, but you could sit on it. It was metal, and it was a lot of fun. We called it a tilt-a-whirl, and everybody would go out and play on it, and we'd just run as fast as we could. Well, I fell off, of course, when it was way up in the air and all the other kids were down on the bottom. And again, I don't remember falling. I don't remember any pain. I don't remember blacking out. But I do remember, again, being in a hospital. That's where the memory stops at the hospital, or the experience with people. I don't remember how I got to the hospital. I don't remember anything of that. But I do remember this pathway, and it was next to the school, and I was walking down this dark pathway, and it was like it was at night all of a sudden. And then all of a sudden there's this beautiful hall with these long flowing curtains and this warm, beautiful air, and everything smelled so good, and the curtains were moving just a little bit, and it was just so inviting, and I was so happy. And I didn't know where it was. I wasn't afraid. I get down there, and I could tell that there were three people there, three men. But I could only see two. And I wasn't asking where I was. I wasn't afraid of where I was. And I started talking to them, but it wasn't really out loud. And I was playing all this time. I was playing in curtains. I was running around. I was climbing and doing things. And they basically said, okay, we want you to do some things for us. And I said, okay, bye. And I can't tell you word for word what was said. It's a long time ago. But I do remember I was told to come back, and I was to find joy, and I was supposed to just love everybody. And I said, okay, fine. And so the next memory I have about all of this, I mean, I remember being home, and my mother started being really overprotective, but something changed in me. People would come into the house, or we would be someplace, and I'd start talking to them about things that were going on in their lives. And I didn't know them. I could talk to them about anything that was bothering them. And all of a sudden, they would be telling me things that were deep in their soul that they had been hurting over. And we would end up laughing and having a good time. And I wasn't ever afraid of the things that they were telling me. They didn't bring me sorrow. They gave me ways of talking to them about things that were hurting. I didn't know that you weren't supposed to talk to people about personal things. So it made my parents a little anxious because, you know, their friends had come over and I would know that they'd had an argument the night before and that they were hurting. My parents didn't know, the neighbors didn't know, but I knew. And so I'd go up and say, did you give her a hug? Did you tell her you're sorry? So my parents started telling me, okay, honey, you cannot tell people these things. I told a woman that she didn't need to be afraid to go to the doctor because she was afraid that she had something wrong with her stomach. And I said, no. She said, I told her that she had been eating the wrong kind of vitamins. And this is at 9 years old. I'm finally to the point where I'm telling them what they're eating is wrong or what they're lacking in their diet or, you know, their dog had been wetting on their blankets and they had got rash from it, so that it wasn't a skin disease. They just needed to. And all these things were coming out of my mouth and I didn't know people. So my parents told me that that was it, that I was not to talk to people anymore about things. I had to start keeping things to myself. I also knew events before they happened, and so I would try to stop them. I knew about car accidents. I knew about maybe someone falling and hurting themselves or something to where I felt guilty because all these people, I couldn't stop what was happening to them. And it would make me very sad knowing that the next time I saw this person, they were going to have a broken arm. Knowing that the next time I saw this person, they may have lost a loved one. And so I was desperately looking for ways to stop all of this. And that's when I visited again down this hall, and I was back at the same age as the first time I went. I was young again. I was happy and I was loving. There isn't a smell that I can even tell you that I've experienced here to how beautiful it smelled. But they were telling me, they told me things to where I could understand them. One of the things that they told me was that just because I knew something didn't mean I had to tell someone else, that it was okay. And that if I knew something, it was because maybe later I could help them. And maybe I couldn't. But just because I knew it, it didn't mean that I had to feel bad. They also told me about rain at this time. That was to explain to me how we interact with a lot of different people, like raindrops in a puddle. They hit, and they were drawing these for me, by the way. And the water goes out, and you can tell as the water goes out, if there's another drop that hits, that that water is going to run into where the circle, the next drop is going to go, and how they overlap. And basically told me how when you meet people, your life changes their life and their life changes your life. And that's a good thing. And it's okay. At the end when I left, they told me to go find joy. At every meeting that I've ever had with them, it's been the same thing. Go find joy. I have never once had a bad experience. I've never been asked if I've been good or bad. I went through a time because I was hiding all of this that I rebelled. It cost me a marriage. I thought I was a bad person. I thought there was something wrong with me. I thought that maybe I was schizophrenic. I thought that there was a real problem. Since then, besides I'm just nuts, and I love people, I love kids, I love art, and I wish I could tell you how good it feels to be around people. I love people. I can't get enough of them. Strangers. We'll start talking about things that don't make any sense to somebody else, and we'll just be happy by the time we quit. And I know that they've shared their joy with me. I tried to reject a lot of things. I tried to disapprove it. After I got divorced and went back to college, I took up tarot cards so that I could, you know, tell fortunes. And we were going to disprove them. And we went through even a double-blind experiment. We made it very scientific. Went through, and the more I tried to be off, the better I got. And then some of the things that I figured out was that everybody has about 50% of the same experience as mine. That everybody makes their own choices how they're going to react. That helped us on further research that we've been doing, and we come up with CD and books and other things like that, and I would love to share those with you. We have art classes. We have what we call life change classes.
Lily, explain who's we.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Class Art School is a art school that I have a business partner with. And Daylily Arts is a nonprofit that we organized so that we could keep arts in public schools. We, as both groups, the business for-profit and the nonprofit, the business for-profit, by the way, hasn't made any money yet, but we're working on it, opened in 1999. And basically, my business partner and myself and several volunteers have served over 160,000 children in public schools. We've worked with senior centers. We're doing Earth Jam. We've done a Christmas box house. We do all kinds of different things. We organize and go out to the general public and try to put real fun things that aren't expensive into the community so that all kids can participate. Work with behavior disorder kids. We work with, well, there's a whole list. The goal is to help everyone find joy, especially children. Children are under more stress now and being torn in more directions than they ever have been. And so if we can just put art back into their lives so that they have an alternative to watching TV or... I'm on a soapbox. I'm sorry. I don't want to get there because I know you can hear something else. Children really need this, and they need to find joy. Adults need to find joy. Seniors need to find joy. Everybody needs to find joy. I wish that there was some way just to communicate how some people can go through months of feeling so alone and yet maybe draw something or paint something or create something and feel that spark of joy, and all of a sudden their life has got a meaning and they're going to take a step further because that this one worked. They can do it. You know, tomorrow I might make another painting. So I can get up in the morning and tomorrow I might be able to do another painting. And if it doesn't work, I have the skills to at least get out of bed this morning. There's things that we do and we share. I have to say that I know that's what I'm around for, was to help people find joy. It's okay, Mom, I can tell people that and not feel bad. So I'm not sure what else you need to know other than that, and I'm rambling now, so I'm going to hand the mic back.